Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, for many people, especially those of us who lived through the 1980s, coronavirus has evoked memories of the AIDS epidemic. A new Channel 4 television drama series, It's a Sin, which has had a massive impact and has been widely critically acclaimed, shines a light on the experience of young gay and bisexual men at that time, the fun and freedom of the early part of the decade, followed by the devastation of HIV and the revulsion and fear that came from ignorance about the disease and how it spreads. Well, I'm joined on the line now this morning by drag queen extraordinaire Rory O'Neill, also known as Panty Bliss, of course, who presents Pantisocracy here on RT Radio 1, and by Bill Hughes, producer, director with his own company, Mind the Gap Films. And Bill was also the producer back in the 1980s of Vincent Hanley's hugely successful television show for RT, MTV USA. Good morning to you both, Bill and Rory.
Good morning.
Hi, Bill.
And good morning, Rory. Yeah.
Listen, I'm going to start with you, Rory. I'm conscious that, you know, many of our listeners may not have had a chance to see It's a Sin yet. So perhaps you tell us about the story at its heart and why it has resonated so strongly at this time.
Well, it's a story about a group of friends living together in a flat in London. Four gay men and their sort of best girlfriend, and their sort of life there, living very young and very free, beginning of the 80s, and then as HIV and AIDS arrive, it affects them all differently, and they each react differently to it. And I guess the two main characters, one is a young guy, and he's a struggling actor, and he's full of the joys of living his young day life after leaving a repressive upbringing. And then the girl, who is sort of the linchpin, and really she's the one who sees what's happening most clearly, and she's sort of the heart of the show, and she's the one who drives them sort of towards activism towards the end of the series.
Some people might say, Rory, look, it's just another television show. But I suppose when a TV show is about people like you, like Bill, experiences you've had, places you've been, it becomes something more. I mean, what were your thoughts, Rory, and feelings as you watched it?
Well, I mean, for me, it was very intensely personal. I mean, I would be slightly younger than Bill, just a couple of years, and I expect that Bill is probably around the exact same age as the characters in the show, and I would have been about 5 years or so younger than them. I would have been in my second year in college when the ad came on the television that everyone remembers, Don't Die of Ignorance, and the Tombstone Falling, all that. So I was in my just coming out of stage, first experience in gay friendship and gay love and all of that. And so to me, it brought up so many memories. And then when it, some of them beautiful and fun and joyous, and then when people start dying in the TV series, it brought up so many awful, sad, terrible memories too. And also in some of the joyous ones too, because I'm remembering people who I knew who died and so on. But what's been amazing to me, really, is about the reaction to it is I think people like Bill and I remember that, and so we're looking at it in one way. But to so many other people, especially younger people and younger gay people too, and I think straight people, especially here in Ireland, which is a bit protected from the whole thing in some ways, that they were almost like discovering it for the first time, mm-hmm. especially younger people. And I think they'd never really thought about what it meant to be that age and to be worried that you might die at any moment, and also to see your friends dying, and often dying horrible, slow, lonely, painful, ostracized death. Because in so many cases, people's deaths were hidden and painful because their families had rejected them. People were afraid of them. People were afraid to touch them or hug them. You know, it was a terrifying and really dark, bleak time. And, you know, people only got through it, I think, in many ways, by having a close group of friends like those depicted in the show.
OK, I'm going to bring in Bill now. And actually, Tom, my producer, is going to try to fix your line. Rory, it's not great. I mean, we'll stick with it if we have to. From your point of view, Bill, watching It's a Sin, what impact has it had on you?
Oh, Miriam, it's like getting into a time machine and going straight back into those days. It's so resonant. It really feels like they've captured the mood perfectly. They've captured the time perfectly. Like, I did my big coming out at drama school in England in the 70s. And then into the early 80s, I was back here in Dublin. And watching the gay scene here trying to come to terms with itself and trying to decide who it was and basing itself around the Hirschfeld Centre. But all the young people finding their identity, and one of the first people that I met when I came back from drama school was Vincent Hanley. And Vincent and I became like inseparable friends. We were never lovers and there was no romantic entanglement of any kind. We just were best friends. Our heads were in the same place. And so when he started to do work in New York and stuff, I would regularly go and visit him. And it began to strike me quite quickly that this thing, AIDS, was very real. Because in the West Village, where we would hang out down in New York, you could just see more and more sick people and more people who were walking around like zombies, that it became such a frightening thing. And I mean people not in their tens, not in their hundreds, but in their thousands were that sick. And so, you know, it was quite terrifying then to see that grip Dublin and very slowly insinuate itself in here. And people saying that, oh, there wasn't really an AIDS problem here. Those people need to have a reality check because, I mean, I have photographs of dinner parties in my old house back in the 80s and maybe eight people around the table, eight guys, and I'm the only one alive. Everybody died of AIDS. And that's a really shocking thing to be able to say, but it's true. And so for the young generation now who don't realize how severe it was, and it really was severe, and the stories that they're seeing in this show where the parents go into denial and the parents don't want to have any, and burning all their belongings and that kind of stuff, that all happened. And that happened, you know, in Donnybrook. That happened in Sandymount. That happened down in Ballinrobe and Ballinasloe and places. People, families were terrified. And as Rory said about touching, people were terrified to touch somebody with AIDS. So that when Princess Diana touched a person with AIDS on the news, she was the first high-profile person to touch a person with AIDS. And that moment is why Diana is remembered so fondly by the gay community, because she broke the stigma.
Yeah, she really did. And Bill, just before I go back to Rory, I mean, you had all your own experiences, you said, about the people around your table who died and lost their lives to AIDS. But in particular, Vincent Hanley, he was so famous here, Bill. You produced his MTV USA. And the fact that initially none of you could say he died of AIDS, isn't that right, Bill?
We really couldn't, and that was out of respect for his parents. Because his parents were normal country Tipperary people who were grappling with, number one, the fact that he was gay. I mean, I remember on the day of his funeral, Miriam, in a Sunday paper, some journalist wrote that perhaps Vincent should not be buried in hallowed ground as he was a homosexual. Like, that was said in the Sunday paper on the day of Vincent's funeral in April 1987. And it wasn't to do with AIDS, it was just because he was a homosexual. But then nobody really could deal with what was... Vincent himself was in denial publicly. Like, he knew he was dying, but publicly he would not articulate that he had dreaded AIDS. And so he went into death fighting with it and fighting with the world. And like for the last day of Vincent's life, just lying in the bed in St. James's, he just said one word over and over again. And that word was no, 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 no. And that haunts me to this day.
God, Bill, he was only 33, of course. Rory, similarly to Bill, I assume you lost lots of friends, did you?
Yes, I did. Now, I was, like I said, a little younger than Bill, so a lot of the friends that I lost were my sort of slightly older friends. Lucky, I guess, of the age that I was. Oddly, some of my very best friends I met at AIDS funerals, at the funerals of, mutual friends and that. Mm. One of the things, that Bill said there about the sort of silence surrounding it, and that's what I sort of meant earlier too when I sort of mentioned that in some ways a lot of Irish people were protected from it at the time. They were protected, not in a good way. They were protected by the silence that surrounded it. In many ways, I often think of it too when we're discussing things like the mother and baby homes and the Magdalen laundries, because anything, in Ireland at the time that had anything, even approaching, sexuality or whatever, was untalked about and hidden and shameful. And so there was a sort of a shame around the whole idea that anybody Irish would have caught AIDS or died of AIDS. And so there was this sort of monumental silence around it. And so people, were told that their neighbour died of cancer or whatever, but so many people didn't know the truth until much later.
Interestingly as well, we've just got an email from Dorothy. He says, as a mother of a gay son in his 30s, I looked at It's a Sin and I'd highly recommend it to parents of all children and for schools. It really let her see when the gay community went through in the 1980s. Also, Rory, in It's a Sin, the music is fantastic. Like, for people watching it, for me, it's the best drama series I've ever seen. I just thought it was unbelievable. I binge-watched it the 5 hours. But, there are great parts of it. It includes artists like Jimmy Somerville. And I remember, too, Bronski Beat's album, Major Consent. It had a list of countries printed on its sleeve in which it was still a crime for two men to have a sexual relationship. And that list, of course, included Ireland. And, Rory, that remained the case until 93 here.
Yeah, 1993, which is really incredible when you think about it. I mean, all through my college years and into my 20s and, 1993, what age I was, I was nearly 30 before it was decriminalised, which is really quite incredible because it's really not that long ago. So we really were slow at those kind of things. There's one thing that I would like to say, though, to make sure that people understand, is that times have changed. So if you're looking at this drama, and of course everything in it is so raw and real, and that was the situation at the time. But of course nowadays, if someone is diagnosed with HIV, if there's somebody listening out there, I'd say don't freak out and don't watch the TV show, because of course the times have changed so dramatically, and there's no need for anyone to die of AIDS anymore. People can still die of ignorance, unfortunately, but not of AIDS. Because treatments have advanced so incredibly, science has been wonderful, and nowadays people like me get on and live our lives and take one pill a day and get on with it. So it's amazing, the show, and it is great to know where we came from and to remember what we've been through. But things are not the same anymore. So I would hate to feel that somebody is sitting somewhere in their living room watching that and thinking that things are the same. They're not.
Because in your case, Rory, I think it was 95 when, am I right in that you got your diagnosis with HIV?
Very, very good, Miriam, yeah.
I have a good producer. But I mean, in other words, can you recall the moment you were told that? And did it feel like an impending doom, like a death sentence for you at that time?
Absolutely it did. When I was diagnosed, it was just right on the cusp of when these new treatments were about to be, developed. But when I was diagnosed, I was told by the consultant that I probably had, I had 1 to 5 years to live. And, and when she told me that, I was very aware of what those 1 to 5 years were going to be like, that they were going to be horrible and hidden and grasping and marked and all of that stuff, because I'd seen it so often already in friends of mine. And for example, when I went to my first visit at the clinic in St. James's, shout out to all the staff in St. James's Guy Clinic, they're amazing. I saw the consultant. She persuaded me to start taking medication, because at the time, a lot of people were terrified of the medications because they came with horrible side effects. And of course, at that time, they weren't really saving people, so people were reluctant to take them. And then I left her office and I go straight in next door into the social worker's office where a social worker sort of held my hand across the table and told me all the ways that they could make dying easier. You know, I'd get a blanket allowance and a nutrition allowance and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was absolutely assumed that I was going to be dead in a couple of years, that I wouldn't be able to work anymore. And they had this sort of conveyor belt set up that would make things as comfortable as possible for you as they trundled you off to the grave. I mean, it was absolutely terrifying.
And also, Roy, I think you waited about a year and a half to tell your beautiful parents, and who were such wonderful people. I mean, was that you building up the strength and willpower to have that conversation with them?
Yes, partly. What it was, you know, I had, of course, taken on a lot of the guilt and shame that was being thrust upon people who are diagnosed with HIV. So I felt guilty and ashamed about it at the time. And I wanted to be able to go down. When I was telling them, I wanted to be comfortable enough with it myself and not be in a, sort of in a, still in a shock myself. But I also wanted to be able to answer every question they could possibly ask me in that conversation. So I spent about a year just badgering the doctors at the Guy Clinic in St. James's with every question, asking them about every treatment and about every diagnosis and about your T cells and all of that stuff. I just wanted to be able to answer any question that they had. So by the time I did tell them about a year, year and a half later, you know, I was a world expert on HIV, you know, by that stage. So that's what I was doing for that year, year and a half. I was dreading it, absolutely dreading it. I would have preferred to tell them 100 times over that I was gay than tell them that I was HIV positive at the time.
Bill, was it a terrifying time? And also, were you able, Bill, to grieve for and bury and say a proper farewell to all those friends of yours you lost?
Oh, Miriam, the funerals were just such... they almost turned into mini festivals. Because that gay sense of humour and that gay sensibility, a lot of people started to have the most elaborate music choices for their funerals and how and all the things that they wanted. So, yes, we got to grieve, and we got to grieve in a way that people are not being allowed to grieve at the moment because of COVID. But in those days, yes, you gathered at the church and everybody was, you know... There were instructions on colour themes, what to wear. There were instructions on the flowers that were to be used. And it was just a mark of the person who had died, how elaborate the funeral was. So it was a completely different time. There was something surreal about it. It was like this was the production that they'd always wanted to do. Just sadly, it was for their funeral, not for a production. Yes, it was. The emotions were raw. The emotions were intense. And hearing that somebody had died, and then the following week somebody else, and the following week somebody else, and they were all guys in their 20s and their 30s, and they had their whole lives in front of them. And they had amazing careers in front of them and relationships to be had and everything. And to just see them snuffed out and just such an army of beautiful young men to just be cut down by this awful disease. And as Rory said, it's not like that now. For people who get a diagnosis now, it is not a death sentence, but it was a death sentence. And that has to be remembered, that people, their lives were snuffed out, and that was the way it went.
Actually, we were due to speak to Andy Bell of Erasure, but he was ill this morning and we couldn't. Rory, I'm going to play now a short clip from your incredible, world-famous Noble Call speech at the Abbey in 2014. Oh. Have a listen, because I want to ask you something straight afterwards.
Okay.
I do know what it feels like to be put in your place. Have any of you ever been standing at a pedestrian crossing when a car goes by and in it are a bunch of lads and they lean out the window as they go by and shout fag and throw a milk carton at you? Now, it doesn't really hurt. I mean, after all, it's just a wet carton, and in many ways they're right. I am a fag. So it doesn't hurt, but it feels oppressive. And when it really does hurt is afterwards, because it's afterwards that then I wonder and worry and obsess over What was it about me? I mean, what did they see in me? What was it that gave me away? And I hate myself for wondering that. It feels oppressive, and the next time that I'm standing at a pedestrian crossing, I hate myself for it, but I check myself to see what is it about me that gives the gay away, and I check myself to make sure that I'm not doing it this time.
Rory, do you still check yourself for gayness? I mean, is that a legacy of the period in which you grew up, or is it because the fear of being targeted for your sexuality remains?
Well, to the first part, do I still check myself? I do on occasion, but much less than I used to. I mean, it's funny because when we were talking there about the funerals and that, I was thinking about one of the positive things, if we're going to look for something positive in that period, that it did was it created an incredible sense of community and solidarity amongst the gay community, which is maybe why we were able to have these sort of defiant funerals and all of that. And I haven't sort of experienced that sort of sense of, you know, community and empowerment really until the marriage referendum came along. And I think the marriage referendum changed psychologically the landscape for the gay community here in Ireland, in that it made us feel, you know, fully accepted as Irish people, as part of the, you know, the fabric of Irish society. And because we did it constitutionally and after a painful referendum where the whole country voted, it also, I think, made us feel very secure in that place in Irish society. And that had this knock-on effect of, yes, I do check myself much less often than I used to, because I do feel very secure as an Irish person and an Irish citizen now, my sexuality included. But does it mean that I never check myself? Does it mean that I don't still carry some of the stuff from growing up in a very different society? Yes, I still carry some marks from that. And does it mean that there are no homophobic people left in Ireland? No, of course there are. And so, yes, I do still check myself occasionally, but very much less often than I used to.
And Bill, from your point of view, I mean, it's lovely as well, Rory's dress he wore during that speech. It's actually on exhibition in our National Museum here in Dublin. But Bill, from your point of view, is there much homophobia and discrimination out there, do you think? Funny enough, we've a lot of texts which I haven't got time to read. Some saying yes, some saying not. It's completely different. What's your experience, Bill?
Can I just say a little statistic here? There are 53 countries in the British Commonwealth, well, 53, and 32 of them, it's illegal to be gay. In 32 of the 53 countries of the Commonwealth today, it's illegal to be gay. So would people get a grip and realise? And you know, there are 13 countries in the world where being gay carries a death sentence. So lads, snap out of your trance that it's all okay. It is not okay globally. And in the same way that we want COVID to be cured globally for us all to move on, homophobia needs to be stamped out globally for us all to move on.
And look, so many texts. I'm just going to read some. This is from Patricia. This will resonate with you, Bill, because it's about Vincent. Patricia says, I lived in New York in 1986 in the Woodward Hotel on 55th Street.
Oh,
I was delighted to find out that Fab Vinny lived there too. I used to bump into him at the laundrette and have lovely chats. Well, one day he had an eye infection, which he said he picked up from a cat in Paris. Shortly afterwards, news broke in Ireland that he had AIDS. He seemed to avoid me after that, and I was always afraid he thought I had told the papers. Listening to your show, I realised that it wasn't anything to do with me and probably due to his feelings of shame and embarrassment. I wish I'd known. That's quite a moving text, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah, and the Woodward, as Vincent used to call it, the Wood Weird Hotel, because it was full of weirdos. So that he was very happy there, right on Broadway, gave us the perfect shot for the Thanksgiving parade up Broadway from his window. And yeah, he was very happy in that building.
Just before I let you both go, I want to read a few more texts. One of our texts says, I'm a woman. I'm the same age as Rory. I thought I was aware of what was happening in the late 80s and early 90s. I had loads of friends, gay and straight, and we talked about HIV and AIDS quite a bit. I thought I was aware of what was happening, but watching It's a Sin showed that I really didn't. I had no understanding of what the gay community was enduring. make sure everyone watches this series. Another goes, Damien Kildare says, Miriam, I agree entirely with Rory. Things have changed, thankfully. I feel it's very important to point out that It's a Sin is an historical drama. Unfortunately, some viewers may continue to think that this is what life is like for gay men still. It's very much not. While there's still no cure for HIV, treatment and preventative measures have transformed since the 80s. Life for gay men nowadays, with the exception of some well-known religious states around the world, you mentioned that, Bill, is very different. Intelligent and informed viewers will know this. And just a couple more. In Cork, one listener says, we were incredibly ignorant, Miriam, about homosexuality. Now we understand more and how people suffered in the past. Another says, there are so many gay men now in their 50s and older who lived a heterosexual life because they felt living as a gay man was a death sentence. So sad. A very quick last word to you, Bill, and then to you, Rory. Bill, do you think there are a lot of people who never came out, who maybe lived, I don't know, a life, a less happy life than they could have?
Oh, yeah. And that's ongoing. And that is ongoing in all parts of Ireland, in cities, in towns, in villages, on farms, all over Ireland. There are gay men who have never come to terms with their sexuality, and they will die with their secret. And it's terrible that that is the case, that they never get a chance to live their life fully as they are and as is natural for them. And I feel that that is the pressure of society. But all we can do is extend a hand of friendship and say, it's there, please come out if you feel it's right for you. Some people genuinely feel it isn't, but that's the way it is.
And Rory, just before I give you the last word, just three very short texts. It's a Sin is an absolutely amazing series. I really enjoyed it. It was so poignant. A must watch for every one of us. Happy, sad, effusive, yet so soft and pulled at your heartstrings. To all the families of men who had AIDS, we really didn't know the half of it. Another says, my aunt, an Irish sister of charity, worked in the first AIDS hospice in London. The hardest thing for her was that most were Irish and her age, and that she couldn't persuade them to tell their families. And then one last person says, it's Colin McGivern, who's director of the British Council. He says, as part of my work, I've been honoured to listen to Rory inspire audiences in South Africa and recently in Poland. He is a fine and true ambassador for today's Ireland. Thank you, Rory. Final word to you, Rory.
Well, what I would just say is things have changed very much, but it is still, there's still a lot of stigma around being HIV positive. As your producers will know, if they've ever tried to find anyone to talk to on the radio about it, they probably only found me and Robbie Lawler.
Bill.
And I know that every time I'm on the radio talking about it, for the next while, I will usually get some emails and that, or letters to the bar from people around the country who are living with HIV and have never told a single soul. They've never told a family member, a friend, a co-worker, nobody. And it becomes this huge millstone around their neck that's sort of slowly killing them. And so I just wanted to say to those people that, honestly, in 99.9 recurring of cases, the reaction isn't as bad as you feared. But if you are sitting out there listening to this and you're thinking of emailing me, go for it. I'm not going to be able to cure you of HIV, but if emailing me makes you feel better, please do.
Okay, listen, Rory and Bill, I really appreciate you both speaking to me this morning. Thanks so much.